hello. Welcome to our program on careers. I'm Irene Lubin, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. I would like to begin today's program with an article which appeared in the Wall Street Journal on the 10th of September. Jobs Revision Shows Weaker Growth. This article was written for the Wall Street Journal by Justin Lehart. The pace of job growth was significantly weaker than reported from early 2024 through earlier this year, the Labor Department's Bureau of Labor Statistics said on Tuesday. The U.S. added 911,000 fewer jobs over the 12 months that ended in March, the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, said, trimming by a bit more than half the 1.79 million jobs that the official data now show. If that holds, it would bring the average pace of seasonally adjusted employment gains from 147,000 jobs a month over the period to a bit over 70,000. The leisure and hospitality sector, which includes businesses such as restaurants and hotels, likely had 176,000 or 1.1% fewer jobs in March than the official data show, the BLS reported. Other sectors registering significantly fewer jobs included retailing, professional and business services, wholesale trade, and manufacturing. In percentage terms, the information sector registered the biggest hit. By total numbers of jobs lost, Tuesday's report marks the largest preliminary revision on record going back to the year 2000. When measured by percent of total jobs lost, the revision represents the largest since 2009 in the wake of the financial crisis. Tuesday's report is just the preliminary part of an annual process in which the Bureau of Labor Statistics updates the job figures from its monthly employer survey using more comprehensive data from state unemployment tax records. The official revision will come in February, and economists suspect it might not be quite as negative. But the report, even though it is for a period that ended nearly a half a year ago, could amplify worries that the job market, which has shown signs of significant weakening since March, started from a lower baseline than previously was known. And it comes shortly after President Trump fired the head of the BLS after the agency published monthly figures in August that he didn't like. A smaller increase in job growth for the period ended March 2025 had been widely anticipated by private sector economists and officials at the Federal Reserve. A footnote in a speech by Fed Chairman Jerome Powell last month said he expected the level of employment will be revised down materially in Tuesday's report. For its monthly jobs figures, the BLS relies on a survey of about 121,000 employers. The Bureau of Labor Statistics on Tuesday said its research suggested the overestimation of employment was likely the result of two factors. First, businesses within its survey reported higher employment in its survey than they did in their quarterly tax reports. And second, businesses that responded to its survey had stronger employment than those that had been selected for the survey but did not respond. One of the survey's shortcomings is that brand new businesses are not included in it, while the BLS also cannot quickly determine whether an employer that stops responding to its survey has gone out of business. The Bureau of Labor Statistics uses a statistical model based on historical data to estimate those employers' births and deaths. But even though this birth-death model mitigates the problem, the job figures in monthly employment reports can still drift away from what really is happening on the ground. The annual revision process is how the BLS corrects for this drift. So to do this, it relies on data from state unemployment tax records that nearly all employers are required to fill out, and which covers about 95% of U.S. employment. That data comes with a substantial lag and is also subject to revision itself because some tax filers are late. The next article that I would like to read for you is from the opinion page of the New York Times, the 23rd of August of this year. This was written by Carl Benedict Frey. White-collar jobs are under threat. Frey is an economist at the University of Oxford and the author of the forthcoming book, How Progress Ends, Technology, Innovation, and the Fate of Nations. A silent recession has arrived for recent college graduates. Over the past 2 years, unemployment among 22 to 27-year-olds with bachelor's degrees has climbed to levels seen during economic downturns. A college diploma used to be an ironclad job guarantee. Today, it seems more like a lottery ticket with shrinking odds. This plunge is just the beginning. As generative artificial intelligence improves, entry-level and service sector jobs may increasingly disappear, threatening not just workers, but also the cities where they live. Recent research by the Brookings Institution shows how San Francisco and San Jose, California, New York and Washington could soon face significant job disruptions thanks to the rise of artificial intelligence. In San Jose, a striking 43% of workers could see AI transform half or more of their tasks. There is little evidence that artificial intelligence has already begun taking jobs en masse. But just as manufacturing towns in the 1960s failed to recognize the looming threat of new technology then, today's leading service hubs risk underestimating the disruption of AI, especially as Silicon Valley races to automate white-collar work. As the history of deindustrialization teaches us, spotting early warning signs is crucial to adaptation and survival. Consider Pittsburgh in the 1960s, when it was still the steel capital of the world. Behind the scenes, a technological transformation was underway. Across the country, many mills began cropping up, employing far fewer workers than old blast furnaces did. Companies in Asia built enormous factories with refined technology, eroding U.S. steel's dominance. It took over a decade for the force of these advancements to be felt fully in America's steel towns. A similar story unfolded in Detroit. In the 1960s, new technologies, including robotics, computer-aided design, and improved logistics, gave foreign manufacturers an edge and allowed car companies to operate smaller, more efficient plants. No longer bound to sprawling, unionized complexes along the Detroit River, the big three automakers expanded into the suburbs, then farther south, and eventually to Mexico and Asia. By 2011, Detroit's manufacturing employment had plummeted roughly 90% compared to what it was in the 1950s. Modern service capitals tell themselves that they are not dependent on one industry, yet diversification may be a thin cushion when the disruptor is a general-purpose technology. Generative AI writes marketing materials, prepares tax returns, cleans data, codes software, and drafts lesson plans. In New York City, the industries most exposed to those tasks, education, professional and technical services, information, finance, and administration, together employ around 35% of the workforce, a larger share than steel or autos ever commanded in their prime cities. Skeptics note correctly that AI is still imperfect, but it does not have to replace workers entirely to have a big effect. It only has to drive down wages or make knowledge work easier and cheaper somewhere else. If a chatbot can help clients with paralegal work, market research, or financial modeling, companies may no longer need to employ so many entry-level workers in Manhattan or in San Francisco. Like the manufacturing jobs of the 1970s, these roles could eventually move overseas. Coding assistants like GitHub Copilot boost developers' productivity by 56%, with the greatest gains among beginner coders. Similarly, AI writing tools enable less skilled writers, including non-native English speakers, to create professional quality documents. As location, linguistic ability, and experience become less critical in determining productivity, the wages commanded by high-cost cities will encourage companies to hire in cheaper markets. Deindustrialization's lesson is not that decline is inevitable, but that reinvention is essential. Pittsburgh and Detroit did not collapse overnight. They stumbled because they failed to nurture new industries in tech and professional services as traditional jobs were vanishing. Throughout the 1970s and 80s, Detroit and Michigan poured subsidies, tax abatements, and infrastructure investments into the big three automakers without ever halting their inevitable decline. Boston, however, took a different path. It reinvented itself repeatedly, first in the early 1800s as a maritime center powering global trade, again in the late 1800s as a manufacturing hub fueled by immigrant labor, and in the late 1900s again as a center of the tech economy and finance. Each leap depended on young talent and innovation, making education the engine of Boston's repeated renewal. So what kind of talent is going to matter in an artificial intelligence age? No government can really foresee exactly which sectors are going to spark the next wave of job creation, but cities can avoid propping up dying industries, as Detroit did, and instead seed new ones. Innovation sprouts in environments that cultivate in-person interaction and experimentation, activities historically nurtured by urban areas from Renaissance Florence to the cities that make up Silicon Valley. That means that government should invest in amenities that attract and retain talented residents, public spaces, fast and affordable transit, top-tier schools, museums, and theaters. It also means making it easier for people to move from job to job and fostering competition. When Michigan began enforcing non-compete clauses in 1985, the flow of workers into emerging industries slowed as many left the state. California took the opposite approach. It restricted non-competes, which allowed engineers at the once dominant Shockley Semiconductor Laboratory to spin out Fairchild Semiconductor and later Intel, making Silicon Valley Semiconductor miracle possible. If local governments don't act, they risk repeating Pittsburgh and Detroit's declines. Knowledge-based roles play significantly more than traditional assembly line jobs, so they sustain a much broader network of local services such as restaurants, retail stores, and transit. The economist Enrico Moretti finds that while each manufacturing job supports about 1.6 local jobs, each high-skilled tech or professional role sustains around 5. If even a small fraction of analysts, developers, and paralegals move to cheaper regions or are replaced altogether by AI, it could have a profound effect on the whole community. But as San Francisco, New York, Seattle, and other service capitals lay the groundwork for innovation, embracing artificial intelligence as a catalyst for new industries rather than just as an efficiency tool, they could change their fate. Now is the time to start drafting the next chapter of urban prosperity. The next article is from the September 5th issue of the New York Times. The title of this is Rising Healthcare Costs Post Challenge for Workers. This article was written for the New York Times by Reed Abelson. Employees of large and small companies alike are likely to face higher healthcare costs with increases in premiums, bigger deductibles, or copays, and will possibly lose some benefits next year, according to a large survey of companies nationwide that was released on Thursday. The survey of 1,700 companies conducted by Mercer, a benefits consultant, indicated that employers are anticipating the sharpest increases in medical costs in about 15 years. Higher drug costs, rising hospital prices, and greater demand for care are also contributing factors, experts said. With the projected increases, this is the fourth consecutive year in which employers and their workers have faced significantly higher costs for health insurance, with next year representing the biggest jump since 2010. A portion of the increases can still be traced to the lingering effects of the pandemic, but experts are saying that the higher costs could represent a significant challenge. I think affordability is a real issue here for their workforce, said Ellen Kelsey, chief executive of the Business Group on Health, which represents large employers that provide health insurance to their workers. Without making any changes to benefits, which would involve moves like shifting more costs to the workers or reducing the benefits, employers said that they expected that next year's increases in health costs will reach nearly 9% on the average. By altering plans, they projected increases overall of 6.5% on the average in health costs next year. A quarter of those surveyed projected double-digit increases for 2026, even after changes to their plans. So, what will higher costs mean for the workers? While companies will impose a variety of measures to control healthcare costs, workers should expect their employers to pass on some of the burden to them. Some companies will increase the insurance premiums deducted from workers' paychecks, while others will increase the out-of-pocket costs workers will pay to see a doctor or to get a prescription. We're at a point now in time where employers are really having to think hard about shifting costs or doing something really disruptive, said Tracy Watts, who is a senior partner and U.S. leader for healthcare policy at Mercer, which is a unit of Marsh McLennan. In recent years, employees have largely been shielded from significant premium hikes. Even as the cost of coverage for a family of four increased to $25,572 in 2024, the share paid by employees has remained relatively stable in recent years, about $6,000 a year on the average, according to KFF, which is a nonprofit health research group. Employees are likely to feel the pinch more acutely, though, given the current economic climate. The context is different today because groceries are more expensive, said Gary Claxton, a senior vice president at KFF. Everything seems more expensive. Many people already are struggling to afford their medical care. A recent poll found that a third of Americans today, about 91 million adults, said that if they were to need medical care, they would not be able to pay for it. People's situations are only going to worsen, said Sarah R. Collins, who is a vice president who studies health care coverage and access for the nonprofit Commonwealth Fund. The drivers are all in the wrong direction in the problems people have in affording health care. Some companies have become hesitant to ask their employees to pay more, worries that workers will skip or delay medical care because they can no longer afford it. For a lot of employers today, they feel that they have stretched their employees as far as they can go, said Sean Greminger, the chief executive, the National Health Alliance of Healthcare Purchaser Coalitions, which represents organizations that offer health benefits. But the workers may have fewer options. Some companies are considering changing the design of their benefits in order to offer less expensive alternatives. Some employers will add a plan that offers tiers of networks in which workers choose to pay less for fewer choices or more for a greater number of options, steering the workers to hospitals where care might be less expensive. Others might feature plans in which the patients have higher out-of-pocket costs when they get care from certain doctors or hospitals. Roughly a third of the employers today are considering offering this kind of alternative plan, according to Mercer. So, why are healthcare costs going up? Benefit experts say the rising costs are the result of numerous factors today, including higher labor costs for healthcare workers and the introduction of expensive new treatments, including pricey weight loss drugs. Prescription drug costs are increasingly a concern, with a lot of the blame placed on both the drug manufacturers and the middlemen overseeing drug benefits, the pharmacy benefit managers for keeping prices high. Some employers are beginning to move towards smaller independent benefit managers that say they will more aggressively pass on savings to their clients and be more transparent about what employers are actually paying for prescription drugs. Both prices and the amount of care being used by employees are rising, said Sunit Patel, Mercer's chief actuary for health and benefits in the United States. Roughly a third of the overall increase is the result of higher prices charged by hospitals, doctors, and other providers, he said. But there is a higher demand for services and specialized expensive treatments for cancer and other diseases are driving medical costs upward. The aging of the population, workers who stay longer in jobs, and the ability to more easily receive care through telemedicine and other means also has fueled costs by expanding access and use, said Ms. Watts of Mercer. Patients are also being diagnosed with cancer at younger ages. Rising hospital prices also are a culprit. Hospitals have encountered labor shortages and higher costs since the pandemic, and many have taken advantage of less competition to raise their prices. A series of economic and policy changes will affect many healthcare sectors. For one, President Trump's decision to impose tariffs on imports from many countries could eventually increase the price of drugs and medical supplies because much of the supply chains begins overseas and those items are largely produced in other nations. Policy changes related to health care under the Trump administration and the Republican-controlled Congress could drop millions of Americans from Medicaid or subsidized Obamacare insurance, driving up costs for hospitals and other providers. They, in turn, often try to recoup losses indirectly by charging employer plans at higher rates. As hospitals and providers see more uninsured, we always worry that those costs will be absorbed in the system and passed along in terms of higher commercial prices, said Don Moulds, the chief health director for CalPERS, P-E-R-S, which offers health benefits to state and local employees in California. So will some employers drop health care coverage as costs rise? In some competitive business sectors, vying for labor's health benefits remain a lure and, to a great extent, are a mainstay of a stable workforce. I think employers are stuck with it because it is such a valuable benefit to employees, said Paul B. Ginsberg, who is a health policy professor at the University of Southern California. Next, I'd like to read from the Work Friend column written by Anna Holmes, which appears in the New York Times. This from a recent issue. The boss's favorite isn't even on staff. The question. My boss, whom I love as a dear friend, has taken to bringing his situationship, aka not his partner or boyfriend, into the office to, quote, work. This man is not an employee of the company, by the way. Sometimes it is 2 full days a week, and the sitch, well, often sit at my desk where private documents are kept or sensitive phone calls are taking place. We work with highly sensitive information on a global scale. So here's a typical day. He'll be signed in around 9 a.m., work unsupervised, or sometimes wander around the office. He'll take calls and he'll enjoy the meager company snacks. Sometimes I'll get work that he's in the office and we'll turn around and go home. My boss has a high position in the company and is beloved. His boss sits on another floor altogether. People who sit near my boss are fed up with this annoying behavior, however. At worst, it is a gross abuse of power, but they are afraid to report. I privately reported to two higher-ups, not his boss, and nothing was done. I don't want him to get into trouble, but this has gone on for over 6 months now, and it is affecting my sanity. The question, of course, comes from one who signs himself anonymous, and the response is, I'm not quite sure there's a way to save your sanity without getting your boss in trouble, or at the very least creating a certain amount of tension in the office. Though he is a dear friend, as you say, the situation is causing you so much consternation that you have already taken steps to report him a couple of times. This suggests to me that the situation is unsustainable. What you don't say in your letter, however, is why you have not spoken to your boss directly about this, and why not try it? I'm curious as to whether your objections are moral, personal, ethical, or all of the above. Is it the mere presence of the situationship in your workspace that you take issue with? Is it a personality issue with the individual? The answers to these questions should help you to determine what steps to take next. For example, personal objections are not worth breaking into the discussion with your boss, but your concerns about privacy and personal workspace are and should be communicated, rather than suggesting your boss's indiscretions are creating discomfort. You should approach him with your concerns about confidentiality and the inappropriateness of your desk space being taken over. This will depersonalize the issue, I think, and make your boss less likely to get defensive. And if you haven't already, go to HR, unless, of course, HR is also so under your boss's spell that it is reluctant to approach him directly. In which case, my advice remains the same. Speak to your boss himself. It may not make a difference, but at very least, you can say that you tried. And this brings us to the end of the time that we have for our program on careers for today. I hope that you've enjoyed listening in and will enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you for listening. I'm Irene Lubin, a volunteer reader, and you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.